So, good evening. So this is a talk on case three in the Mumin Kan Gute's One Finger Zen. Peter asked me to address this and not to use any allusions to anything else. Whatever he was asked about Zen, Master Gute simply stuck up his finger. He had a boy attendant. A visitor asked, "What kind of teaching does your master give?" The boy held up one finger, too. Hearing of this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. As the boy ran away, screaming with pain, Gute called to him. When the boy turned his head, Gute stuck up one finger. The boy was suddenly enlightened. When Gute was about to die, he said to the assembled monks, "I received this one finger Zen from Tenryu. I've used it all my life and have not exhausted it." Having said this, he entered Nirvana. The movement's commentary is a little bit like what Peter was describing with the playfulness of the enlightened monks bantering with one another. The enlightenment of Gutai and the boy have nothing to do with the tip of a finger. If you realize this, Tenryu, Gutai, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with one skewer. The verse is, "Old Tenryu made a fool of Gutai, who cut the boy with a sharp blade. The mountain deity Korai raised his hand, and lo, without effort, great Mount Ka, with its many ridges, was split in two." So I'm going to begin by following a principle of rabbinical training when you're reading the Torah, which is, if you want to pay respect to a text, you must resist it. And in classical Torah studies, there's one guy here, they each have their books, they're looking at the text, and then they just talk about it, and they talk about it, and they argue about it. And then when they've arrived at meeting of the minds, then they move on to the next sentence. So this koan, which comes so close to the starting gate of the Mumin Kan, must have a central lesson for us. You'll remember that the first one is Mu, which wipes out everything. And then there's Hakujo and the Fox, which is a half-supernatural tale about what happens if you misuse absolute awareness. So what do you suppose that lesson might be? On a literal level, it might be, you better be damn serious about realization, or I'll cut off a limb of yours. I'll symbolically castrate you. It's one of a number of very important koans and stories that you could call the bodily harm group. It includes Nansen, killing the cat, and also the story of Huike chopping off his arm to show Bodhidharma how sincere he is. And that might be the self-harm, bodily self-harm subgenre. On a literal level, these koans are more extreme than a much larger group of koans, which we call the corporal punishment group. Corporal punishment, until quite recently, was considered a good pedagogical practice in American public schools and is still practiced in millions of homes. In fact, I once tried spanking my son. It was at 2 a.m. on the night we had returned from a year in Ireland, about 20 hours, and my son was going berserk. He was about 5 or 6 or something. And I can't remember what it was he was doing, but I chased after him, threatening to spank him. And I actually did spank him once before he laughed at me and wriggled free. So it was the most idiotic and one of the most idiotic and impotent moments of my childhood. There's a difference between what I did and what dear old Chow Chow did when he smacked somebody for being dumb, for not waking up. And that's the difference between skillful means and inept means, or inept means and skillful means. But I wonder if smacking someone is ever skillful, or is it ever the most skillful means available? That's the thing that has been in my mind when we go through these violence koans. And so I'm just going to explore it a little bit, probably a little more than it deserves. In one way of looking at it, again, we're just on the literal level here. It's a question, did the ends justify the means? In terms, perhaps this is a trivial question or even an asinine question to ask of a koan that has such richness for us. And it may be just an example of ignoring cultural context. But still, there is an ethical principle of the means and the ends. If we use a moral or otherwise dubious means to attain a worthy end, then we change the end, we deform it and lower it. Maybe that is the case with any form of physical violence, or maybe that's just a limited view. It is a limited view, because if that's all we take away from this koan, we're missing a great deal. This question occurs to almost everyone when they first read this koan, I think, and often beginning students ask about this. And the usual answer to the question about, what about that violence, is the one that I already mentioned, which is you have to understand the context. And the koan. This is 6th to 9th century China, and whacking was not out of whack. Another response to these inquiries is that these apparent violent encounters may just be metaphorical, or no more than love taps, or skillfully applied blows of the kiyosaku. I have my reservations about that. I think that there are koans which are clearly mythological and meant to be metaphorical because they have no possible literal grounding. Like the fox, for example. I mean, we don't think that the guy was transformed into a fox. I mean, there's many of these. We don't actually think people walk off the top of a 100-foot pole either. So we're bidden to read those symbolically right away. It's got the taste of an actual event. And another response to these is that physical blows have a long history of waking people up, of provoking kensho. So if they're effective, maybe they're justifying. But we're looking at one that's more extreme than just, bonking somebody. When Gute chops off the finger of the boy who is his disciple, it provokes a realization. Certainly sharp discipline, sharper than we practice here, is a common precursor of enlightening experiences. This is evident in the very fact that most teachers to this very day have sticks, which are symbolic these days, and a sort of a venerable accoutrement. But the argument about considering context can cut both ways. The historical violence in Zen can also be seen in its historical context as deriving from a patriarchal system and a monastic system. And when you put men together and deprive them of sex, frustration mounts, and sublimated or not, violence will flare. As far as I know, we don't hear much criticism of the physical abuse in these koans until Zen makes it to the United States and women are in the audience, and 50% women are in the audience, and then suddenly the violence stops, or it's greatly curtailed. In the Mumenkan, we see it right off the bat, no pun intended, at the beginning of the case. It's as if to say, stop copying me, kid. I'm going to lop off your finger if you don't awaken to your true nature. Every time we pass over this violence by saying, well, that was then, or we focus on a view that it was skillful means to liberate the boy and not pay attention to the violence, we're actually complicit in that violence. And I don't think we should freak out about it, but it is stained with the excess of patriarchy. And patriarchy elevates power and force over connectedness. And patriarchy has done a great deal to turn this planet into a cinder. Certainly today, if any Zen teacher cut off a boy's finger, he would go to jail. If we rationalize this, what we're doing is countenancing the behavior. And by repressing it, we strengthen the subtle bond, the us versus them bond, that characterize most groups. We can say to ourselves, Zen is serious stuff. But we don't even have to say that. We don't even have to think it. Just act as if that is part of what makes Zen Zen. Back when they were serious. I wonder if it has to be this way. We can look at other sects of Buddhism, for example, Thich Nhat Hanh's sect. We don't hear too much about physical violence in that sect, although, who knows, I don't know. Insight meditation, which is, grows out of Theravadan Buddhism, at least in this country, you know, eschews violence. In Tibetan monasteries, there's a lot of discipline. And indeed, the Dalai Lama was subjected to pretty severe discipline, limiting his connection with other people when he was a kid. But the Dalai Lama is not going around whacking people. So the question is, what happens if a teacher points out this violence? Are we better off then, as I just did? Does that make the pointer outers better than those who don't point them out? What if, in pointing out the violence, you just create another invidious dualism where the group is bonded? Now we can all see through the stupidity and the nascence of patriarchy. Does this do anything to break the endless chain of man handing on misery to man? I mean, is there not a patriarchal element in what I'm saying right now by leveling these criticisms? What if these Zen teachers are projecting and disowning their own suppressed violence, the ones who are criticizing it? I resemble that remark. Given how strongly I feel about this subject, I am sure that I'm guilty of that to some degree. I have anger and violence aplenty. I notice it regularly. I don't see a quarter of one. I'm not conscious of a quarter. But what if we, a Zen teacher, stopped right here and we made the moral of the story, don't give your power away to teachers who use disproportionate means, disproportionate to ends? What if a teacher just didn't move on beyond the literal level of this koan and miss the marrow, the really challenging and liberating part of this koan? What if in delivering his talk, a Zen teacher trashes Gute for violence and points out that Gute copied his one-fingered Zen from his own teacher and didn't feel any compunction in imitating him? If that's where we left it, it would be a travesty. If there are blemishes, we need to point them out, but it's evident that Gute calls to his student, and the student looks back, that Gute has all along, even in this brutality, been intent on liberating his student. He's not just expiating his own guilt at having picked up one-fingered Zen from his teacher. His own use of one finger had been authentic, even though it mirrored his own teachers of practice, but he doesn't feel that that's what's happening with the boy. In Gutai's mind, realization vastly expands and also chastens the everyday. We are not separate. From the ultimate point of view, chopping off the finger creates the greatest possible opportunity for one to save all sentient beings. Gutai was using the teaching moment to utterly liberate a young person who could then go and liberate all beings throughout space and time. You can't really be on the pathless path if you are aping somebody else. But that doesn't mean we can't learn from others. Zen is serious. To realize ourselves, to summon or pursue strict one-pointedness requires enormous discipline. And there are levels of that game. few of us are in the major leagues of samadhi for more than an occasional moment. And even still, we are who we are. And we do have the responsibility to drop the face we make to meet the faces that we meet. Celibate patriarchy aside, one thing that experience shows us is that when we are brought low, when we figuratively lose a finger, or literally lose a loved one, or get that extra special diagnosis, we are likely to be opened up. We will be bleeding, and we have a chance then to freshly realize how limited a time we have on this earth, a blink. And we may also realize how vast compassion is and how bottomless compassion is and how glorious is every moment. It's one of those paradoxes of suffering. In Japan, the index finger is called the ego finger. Maybe Gutai's pupil lost his ego finger. It's likely, even without that finger, he carried on with the Dharma, all the more urgency because the loss had given him the keys to heaven on earth and hell, and beyond heaven and hell. All of us are in one form or another amputees. I was so struck by the poem that Peter read. Think of how many figurative fingers that guy has had lopped off. How much, as he even says, how much suffering and degradation has he endured? And then, bam, out of the center of that comes that compassion. How unlikely is that? So we have lost a lot just by being alive. We have cut off many possibilities for helping others, by being preoccupied with ourselves. And yet, here we are. We are learning by sitting here for a period of time that we can face our pain. We are learning that we can find our own true flavor of the Zen. It's there already. We're gradually becoming aware of its savor. Maybe our Zen is two-fingered Zen, or maybe it's just this. All of us here are literally together and literally apart. Ultimately, we are heirs to greed, anger, and ignorance, and ultimately, we are enlightened and perfect as we are. Whether we have 9 fingers or 10. Case 3, Gutai's finger. Whenever he was asked about Zen, Master Gutai simply stuck up his finger. He had a boy attendant whom a visitor asked, "What kind of teaching does your master give?" The boy held up one finger too. Hearing of this, Gutai cut off the boy's finger with a knife. And as the boy ran away, screaming with pain, Gutai called to him. When the boy turned his head, Gutai stuck up one finger. The boy was suddenly enlightened. When Gutai was about to die, he said to the assembled monks, "I received this one-fingered Zen from Tenryu. I have used it all my life, but have not exhausted this." Having said this, he entered nirvana.
Creations are numberless. I bow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. I bow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I bow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I bow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I bow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I bow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to receive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.
Okay, good. So I wanted us to get done a little early tonight because I want everybody to be able to get a good night's rest.